Coming up on today's 21st, in schools across the state, classes are being canceled because there aren't enough teachers.
We have an impending teacher shortage around the state. You know, for me as a downstater, we're really feeling this in some of our rural communities that are trying to attract, you know, high-quality math and science teachers.
That's State Senator Jason Berkman. He and some superintendents from around the state join us later. Plus, what effect do pigeons, crows, and geese have on our cities? We'll be talking about that and in other animal-related news. How to avoid pet obesity. Here's one tip: avoid feeding them Thanksgiving leftovers. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their weekends. As we do on Mondays, we like to talk about state politics. And what we're going to talk about today, last week, Governor Bruce Rauner signed two sexual harassment bills into law. One that lifts a one-year statute of limitations, allowing the new inspector general to investigate old complaints. The other requires sexual harassment training for lawmakers and lobbyists. As we do on Monday, we're talking state politics today with WBEZ political reporter Dave McKinney, who's on the line from Chicago. Hey, Dave, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. Dave, we've heard so much in the past few weeks, not just on the 21st, but across all of the news about different news of sexual harassment, particularly as it relates to what's happening within the state house. At the end of last week, as I just mentioned, Governor Rauner signed two new bills. Can you first tell me about the one that addresses the statute of limitations? What was it before, and what does the new bill allow for?
Well, I mean, the crux of that bill deals with this period of time when there was not a legislative inspector general to investigate, you know, more than two dozen cases of ethics, potential ethics lapses by members of the General Assembly, staff, people within the legislature. And what this bill did was basically allow that investigation to go on for those cases beginning dating back all the way to 2015. The way the law reads now, there is an 18-month period that's a statute of limitations, meaning that there has to be a founded complaint filed with the Legislative Ethics Commission after the point of violation for that to be considered a viable complaint. And these cases, 27 of them in all, were outside that window of time. So that was what that bill aimed to do. And Rauner, in signing this bill, included a message with it that said, look, I don't think that this bill doesn't fully deal with the problem. He cited that 18-month statute of limitations is a problem to him, and he would like to see that eliminated. And he has some other issues with the whole legislative ethics process. It's a very secretive process, and he sort of grudgingly made clear that he was going along with what the General Assembly sent him on that point.
Well, the second law was also for training and prevention. Do we know what kind of training that's going to entail?
Well, I mean, legislators during their final week of the fall session, a week ago, began undergoing these training sessions. I mean, they're online. They basically are sort of, you know, typical. They lay out scenarios, and it's you have a multiple question or multiple choice format that people choose, and then once it's completed, then you're certified. It's very similar to the ethics test that everybody has to take now in state government, and so this is just another prong of that. And it's something that just breezed through the General Assembly. Rauner signed it without question, and on both of these cases, I mean, Rauner obviously is trying to get out in front of this problem where every day we seem to be experiencing a new case of sexual misconduct all over the place.
Dave, as someone who's taken those online sexual harassment trainings, full disclosure, if people do not realize, I am a state employee because our station is based at the University of Illinois. I have to say, a lot of times they're, you know, I'm not sure how much you can actually learn from them. I know the intent is probably very good, but oftentimes it's just how fast can you get through this? And it's kind of a video with things. I mean, is there a sense that this is something lawmakers will take seriously? Is this something that could actually change the culture?
Well, it's evidence of them trying to do something to deal with the problem. But yes, you're very right about that. I mean, you know, I remember doing a story back during my time at the Sun-Times back in the Blagojevich era, where I think these ethics exams started in 2004, if I'm not mistaken. And I FOIA'd a listing of all the ethics exams that Blagojevich took as governor. And, you know, he passed them with flying colors, and we all know what happened in his case. So I think to answer your question about whether they work or not, they didn't seem to work in Blagojevich's case. I think people who are putting these out, the sexual harassment testing, are hoping that, you know, there's a different result.
Right. So I guess the question is maybe this is a start, but I imagine this isn't going, this whole notion of sexual harassment, particularly in the Capitol, is not a topic that do you think that lawmakers would say both of these bills and Governor Brown are signing this as a start, but they're not finished?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it seems like, you know, so far, I mean, we've had, we've had the open letter that laid out a whole series of alleged misconduct on the part of a lot of unnamed people. And the only instance where somebody has been publicly named involves State Senator Ira Silverstein from Chicago's Northwest Side, where, his accuser said that, while she was trying to get him to carry legislation on her behalf, there began a fairly lengthy back and forth between the two of them over Facebook that in her mind turned inappropriate. And that was a very shocking, jolting experience to have her testify in a committee in Springfield about what had happened between the two of them. And of course it cost Silverstein or caused him embarrassment, and it cost him a spot on the Senate Democratic leadership team. So it would not surprise me, given the pace that these things are happening, that we see more of these shoes dropping in Springfield potentially. We certainly are seeing them across the country happening on a daily basis almost, with today the New York Times reporter Glenn Thrush, there's news of him being engaged in this problem. So I don't think that the end is near by any means.
Dave, I wonder if we could switch away from politics for just for a moment to ask you about Amazon in the race for the second headquarters in Chicago. There's been some reports that there's some Amazon representatives in Chicago today.
Well, the Sun-Times columnist Michael Sneed had an item in her column today about some Amazon representatives visiting a site that is believed to be, at least in the Illinois package, believed to be one of the favorites. These potential sites in Illinois. Of course, you know, there are more than 200 submittals across the country. There's no guarantee that Illinois is going to land this second headquarters that Amazon is wanting to build with 50,000 jobs earning 100,000 or more. But the site that Sneed reported on is on the north side. It's called the Finkel Steel site, which is in the Bucktown and Lincoln Park area. And it's an old steel plant that has been leveled. It's along the Chicago River, and as Sneed reported, there were representatives there last week taking pictures of the property and just kind of sizing it up. It's a big empty spot in a very desirable situation. And you know, in all the states and cities that are vying for this, we have not seen reporting really much of anywhere about Amazon making visits like this. I suspect a lot of it is going under the radar because it's a very secretive process. But it would seem to buoy hopes in Chicago that there might be some life to this proposal.
Right, and could be a huge economic news, not just for the city, but for the state. That's WBEZ's political reporter, Dave McKinney. Dave, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Nella.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For some time, we've been hearing about a teacher shortage across Illinois. We had a glimmer of light when Democrats and Republicans in the Senate came together this past summer, helped approve legislation that revamps how the state's money is distributed to schools, with more of it being steered to poorer districts. It was a much-needed change to the state's funding formula, but it will be a while before students, parents, and schools reap the rewards of the law. In the meantime, schools are having a harder time than ever finding qualified teachers to fill vacant positions, leaving some having to cancel classes altogether. To be exact, we're talking about 2,000 unfilled educator jobs. That's according to the State Board of Education. And as revealed in a new survey from the Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools, 16% of schools have canceled classes or programs because of a lack of teachers. Three quarters, 75% of districts had fewer qualified teacher candidates during the 2015 to 2016 school years compared to the year before. I'm joined now by two superintendents from two districts that are acutely aware of this problem. Chuck Blyer has spoken to us about this issue before, so we wanted to check back in with him to get an update. He's at Pope County Community School District 1. He's on the line from Golconda in southern Illinois. Dan Cox is a superintendent of schools for Staunton, CUSD number 6. He's actually on the line with us from Springfield. Superintendent Cox, Superintendent Blyer. Gentlemen, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Nyla.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having us.
Hi, good morning. Superintendent Blyer, both of you just returned from a statewide educational conference, the Triple I. How much was the teacher shortage in sort of the ranking of conversations that all the superintendents were having? Where did teacher shortages rank?
Well, in my case, for rural schools, which were quite rural, it's a hot topic for us. We just can't find qualified people to fill positions anymore. The conference, of course, was covering numerous topics, but in the hallways and in and out of different meetings, this was definitely a hot topic for all us administrators and school board members, too.
Superintendent Cox, what's the common issue you're hearing from your peers about the lack of teachers, whether it's in rural, urban, small or large districts?
I think there's really three main issues that we're focusing on. The top and first and foremost issue would be the licensure. Also supports for teachers and students, including social-emotional supports, and then low starting salaries.
Okay. Superintendent Blyer, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Those are actually my three, too. The licensure has really changed over the last few years, actually probably over the last decade, and it's just made it – they just put more hoops for – prospective teachers in college to try to get through, and it wears them down. And then, of course, there's money involved every time they have to go through another level of commitment. And finally, they have to do an additional time as a student teacher, which is, of course, more money out of their pocket. So there's a lot of reasons why teachers, and of course, the starting pay is really low for a college educated person.
And Superintendent Blyer, what are we talking about in terms of numbers? We are going to get to, I want to talk about the licensing in a minute, but how is that relating to how many applicants you're seeing now versus, say, 10 years ago?
10 years ago, you need to go back 20 years. And 20 years ago, when I got back into the field, there were could have easily dozens, and in some larger communities, over 100 applicants for maybe an elementary ed job. But then as the years went by, these have dwindled. So in this case, last year I had to discontinue a program in home economics, which we couldn't find a teacher anywhere. And as far as other applicants I had one applicant for a PE teacher. I had two applicants for a science teacher. So that's what we're down to now, one, two. And even in the case of some districts, they're actually looking to try to find some to bring retired people back and teach part-time just to get the accreditation needed through the ESSA or No Child Left Behind.
Superintendent Cox, what about you all? What's it looking like for you guys in southern Illinois?
Well, what we've seen, and I would agree, the 10 to 20 years, we've seen the number of applicants decrease. It was not uncommon for an elementary teaching position a decade ago to receive 100 applicants. Now you may receive, you may be lucky to receive 10 applicants. And that's a position that was a very popular position. In your specialty areas like your vocational classes, your sciences, algebra, trigonometry, calculus, your math and sciences, it's very difficult to find the applicants. The number of applicants or number of students entering teacher prep programs at universities has decreased significantly as well. Depending on the university, you'll see the decrease in students taking those courses from 20% to as high as 83%. And even more disproportionately, we've seen the number of African American and Hispanic teaching candidates decrease significantly, which again disproportionately affects schools and students in the urban or in poverty and high minority areas of the state.
And so for you, Superintendent Cox, if you had to, we heard Superintendent Blyer say, for example, he cut Home Ec. Are there specific programs or areas you've had to cut also?
At Staunton Schools, we've been fortunate we have not had to do that yet. We are looking proactively into the future, though, how we would maintain those positions. Our biggest concern here would be in our vocational trades programs as teachers retire, or if they would happen to leave unexpectedly, we'd have a very difficult time filling that. So we're in conversations regionally as superintendents of what we can do to maybe pool our resources in order to still provide positions for kids moving into the future, or classes for kids moving into the future.
We're going to have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to find out a little bit more about pooling resources. Superintendent Cox from Golconda, Superintendent Blyer from Golconda, and Superintendent Cox from Staunton are going to be sticking around with us. We're also going to be hearing from some lawmakers. State Senator Jason Berkman, Senator Kimberly Lightford are going to be joining us as well to talk about what they're doing on the legislative side to try to address this issue of teacher shortages in Illinois. Thanks for being with me. Stay tuned. We're going to, just on the other side of the break, pick up this conversation. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the shortage of teachers in Illinois. To be precise, more than 2,000 unfilled positions across the state. We're going to continue chatting with two superintendents from the southern and southwest areas of the state in just a bit. But first, we've got some senators who've been working to improve schools and school funding joining me. Joining me now, State Senator Jason Berkman. He's a Republican representing Illinois' 53rd Senate District in Central Illinois, a very key part of the bipartisan effort to redistribute funding to schools this summer. Senator Berkman, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me on, Nyla.
We were just hearing from two superintendents about the issues they're facing with the lack of teachers. We heard the problems they listed for their top three, problems with licensing, problems with teachers feeling supported, and then, of course, money and pay. This has been a really important issue for you. I know you and your colleagues on the State Education Committee recently met in Decatur to address this. What are you working on your end to deal with the teacher shortage issue?
Yeah, I think this is an important debate, that kind of discussion, maybe not a debate, but a discussion that we're having around the state. There's been a recognition, I think more so today than ever before, from the legislature that this shortage is real, that it exists, and that that there's probably, you know, more that we can do about it. I think we're all aware of the tough financial times in Springfield, and are looking for solutions that are not as that are more profound, I suppose, than simply saying we need to throw more money at the problem. There are areas where money is the problem, and where you need to see teachers' salaries lifted up. But I think there's some other things that we can do in the legislature. You know, as you specifically look to where these shortages exist. I know, you know, myself as a legislator from Central Illinois, we're certainly feeling the shortage in many of our rural communities. That's not to say that those are the only areas that the shortage exists, but you know, I represent nearly 40 school districts, many of them, districts in our rural communities, farm communities, and those school systems are having a tough time identifying whether it be your science, you know, and technical teachers, some of your special ed, tough to recruit. But again, I think there's more that can be done, and there's more than just the salary aspect. You know, the reality is it's tough to recruit teachers to our rural communities unless those teachers are from the area or are married to someone from the area. So, you know, I think we'll look at some incentives and various ways that we can approach what is a very challenging issue.
I'm speaking with Republican State Senator Jason Berkman. As he mentioned, his district's it's Illinois' 53rd Senate district. It includes all or parts of Ford, Iroquois, Vermilion counties, and more. Senator Berkman, you said incentives, particularly in rural areas. What are lawmakers talking about in terms of, as you said, not necessarily money? We've even heard with licensing. Is there any discussion about making that easier also?
Yeah, you know, we've looked at the licensing aspects, and you know, you can compare Illinois to other states and see that other states have relaxed or the burden that's imposed on someone trying to obtain a teacher certificate is less rigorous in other states. And you know, we're of course sensitive about creating a scenario where we're not attracting highly qualified teachers. But the reality is we can change the regulatory system, the restrictions that are placed in, are put in place, I think, without jeopardizing the quality of education that our teachers provide. So that's certainly an area that we're looking at. I think, you know, when you think of incentives, you know, I think of something that's targeted in mind that doesn't put a burden on a school district to, you know, increase necessarily their teachers' pay, but creates a pot that some can tap into, some who are in those areas where the need is the greatest. Maybe they can use that pot, similar to like a Teach for America and programs like this, that create incentives to go to districts and to fields where the need is highest. And I think that the other piece that's worth mentioning here is that certainly our teachers and future teachers have been demonized, unfortunately, over the last many years. They've become a bit of political targets, and the effect of that has been that some have either been discouraged at looking at a teaching career or have looked at a teaching career outside of Illinois. So as lawmakers, I think we can set a better example of the good work and the public service really that's done by those who choose to go into teaching, and hopefully we can change the culture on a profession that's incredibly important to another generation of young people needing to earn high quality public education.
That's State Senator Jason Berkman. Joining me now is State Senator Kimberly Lightford. She worked with Senator Berkman on the bipartisan effort this past August to redistribute and change the funding formula for schools. She's a Democrat. She represents Illinois' 4th Senate District in Chicago's western suburbs. Senator Lightford, thanks for being with me as well.
Thank you for having me.
You know, as we just hear Senator Berkman talk about teachers and being how much they have been attacked, earlier we were having conversations with superintendents about just the emotional support and moral support for teachers in terms of recruitment and retention. There's been so much discussion about the state's reputation and the damage that the budget impasse has done to our public education system, which is, of course, directly because of the inability by lawmakers and the governor to pass a budget for the past 2 years. I wanted to ask you, Senator Lightford, and you as well, Senator Berkman, if you all feel responsible in part for this problem because of the fact there wasn't a budget for the past 2 years.
So I realize that there wasn't a budget, but I don't know that this is something to blame the governor on or the General Assembly for the last 2 years. Teacher shortage has been an area that was identified years ago as
sure,
a challenge
right.
if we would not begin to find ways to make changes to draw more teachers into our state and to encourage more young people to go into the profession. I mean, we've been working on this in terms of small fixes along the way. I just think now we have a more concentrated effort to come at this as a collective whole and figure out how we can change another systematic problem. The foundation formula was also another systematic challenge that we had to address. So this goes back to a bill I remember I sponsored, gosh, had to be early 2000s, that provided incentives for teachers to teach in low-income districts by giving them housing allowances. We've tried a number of small fixes, but they're not permanent enough, and we're still here years later realizing now this teacher shortage.
Yeah, and Senator Berkman, would you say, I don't know if you think this exacerbated a problem, obviously that the budget impasse exacerbated a problem that already, as Senator Lightford has pointed out, and certainly everyone's aware of, has existed for decades?
I agree with Senator Lightford. This has been an issue that I think that's been out there. The budget, you know, certainly not having a budget has been felt directly and indirectly by, you know, lots of different, you know, professionals and otherwise, and state actors and otherwise. So, you know, there may be an indirect effect. There certainly was an effect on our higher ed community, you know, and our higher ed community is part of the system that educates those who become our public teachers. So, you know, there might be an, you know, a little bit less of a direct impact on it, but, you know, moving forward, I think there's things that we can do collectively to work together to change the environment so that people are attracted to and want to become public school teachers, and we can make the process streamlined for them to be able to do so.
Right. Senator Lightford, you signed a letter to the State Board of Education asking them to quickly look into the teacher shortage so that you and your colleagues in the State House would have more time to pass legislation before the next school year. What in particular do you want them to look into? We've heard Senator Berkman and the superintendents talk about licensing. I don't know how important you think the teacher pay situation is in this issue.
Oh, I do. I believe that we need to take a look at how to better encourage even high school students to attract them back to the profession. I've gone to many places in schools, and there's always career days, but there's never a teacher promoting the profession of teaching. And so when I checked our university pool, the percentage of enrolled students right now for early childhood education or an education degree is less than 5% in our state universities. So currently, we're not doing our best in trying to attract more young people into the profession of teaching. That's why we have over 2,000 unfilled positions statewide. So it's nothing new that just started, but I think that we should do a better job in marketing the profession, and that includes better pay as an attraction. If you're looking to encourage young people today to take on this profession and then at the same time say, well, teachers don't make any money, I think we're not really offering a competitive career for young people to begin to see themselves in, that they can raise a family off of being a teacher. So I know we need to work there. I agree with my colleagues in terms of all of the requirements for teachers living in other states to come into our state, taking a look at the basic skills test and why it's so challenging there. But I'd like for us to also, while students are doing their last year in help me out, Barry.
Their student teaching last year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they're doing their student teaching, it's like we're putting them in this classroom setting, which is amazing, but what are we doing to ensure that they have everything that they need to pass the basic skills test? I don't know that they're, because if they can't pass it after the first attempt, the second attempt, we had it 3 attempts, then we raised it to 5 attempts, then we moved it indefinite. So it's kind of one of those things. Well, let's look at this basic sales test. Are we actually teaching these methods while they're earning their degree, or are we just giving them something blanket that we expect them to attain and it hasn't been taught throughout their college days? So I think we really need to look at how we're teaching versus the requirements of this basic skills test as well.
Last question for both of you. Senator Berkman, let's start with you. Both of you have talked about different areas, and I wonder, as two who have worked across the aisle together on this issue, what if you can just sort of name the top issue that you think there's bipartisan agreement on that you all will be working for as sort of your priority in the coming year. Senator Berkman, is it for streamlining licensures, or what do you think there's most bipartisan agreement on that you're going to be working towards?
Yeah, I think as we look at the kind of the regulatory scheme, there's an opportunity there for some bipartisanship. I think, interestingly, there's opposition to changing the licensing process. There's opposition to that arises from members of both caucuses, you know, and it's kind of a reflective concern of not dumbing down the process and the requirements for teachers. That said, I think those who are looking into this deeper recognize that we're doing things different than other states. Other states are still putting forward highly qualified teachers. We ought to look to those other states for examples of how they approach the regulatory scheme for teachers. I think there's a great opportunity there for some bipartisanship.
Senator Lightford?
I think here's an awesome opportunity for us to take a look at our academia at the university level as it relates to attaining a degree in education, so that we can make sure that we can, after you've completed a task of earning a degree, that you can actually go into the field. You find so many individuals that can't pass the basic skills test. Now what else do I do with this education degree? And so I think it's really important that we make that distinct connection.
That's State Senator Kimberly Lightford. She's a Democrat representing Chicago's western suburbs. I also want to thank State Senator Jason Berkman, who's a Republican representing parts of lots of central Illinois. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We've also had our superintendents that we were talking to before as we were talking about the state's teacher shortage. And I want to go back to them. Dan Cox from Staunton in the southwest area of the state, from Staunton, and Chuck Blyer, who's with Pope County Community Schools in Golconda. Superintendent Blyer, as you just listened to Senators Berkman and Lightford talk about their priorities, do you think that that's aligned with what superintendents want?
Yes, I have no issues at all with what they said. They were both spot on, and they both are well-versed in educational policy. So, yes, and I thought they hit on everything that me, as someone who's been in education for a while, it's kind of all I've run into as an educator. But it's now up to them to kind of move forward. I do agree with their assessment. I don't think the budget really had much of an impact on what happened or what is happening. I think it's more deeper. So I do I appreciate that they are seeing it as a deeper issue rather than just more of a surface-level issue.
Yeah, Superintendent Cox, what do you think?
Well, I guess one area I would disagree with is on the budget. I think the budget impasse did have a direct impact. It is deeper than that, and it's been long before. The issues we're dealing with have occurred long before the budget impasse, but it certainly didn't help. We school districts were bleeding through their reserves, and teachers saw that. Candidates saw that, and they weren't going into the profession. As far as the other things they brought up, they are right on line, starting with the licensure issue.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to just quickly wrap up with the superintendents. I want to just get your feedback, gentlemen, on the idea of being able to attract highly qualified teachers and perhaps the perception around streamlining the licensure process. I also want to ask you about pooling resources. Superintendent Cox, you mentioned that. I want to find out a little bit more about how you all are coping with this Illinois teacher shortage problem. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We're going to finish this conversation just after the break. We'll be right back.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
For tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Illinois' teacher shortage as a crisis that's gone on for decades. We've been talking about, from the lawmaker perspective, what folks are doing in the State House. I've got two superintendents on the line from south and southwest of Illinois, Dan Cox and Chuck Blyer, who have been talking to us about how they've been dealing with, across the state, the at least 2,000 unfilled teacher positions. We've been hearing about programs being cut, classes being canceled, how they're handling it. Superintendent Cox, I believe earlier you said that you were looking at pooling resources and trying to have sort of more of a regional approach to this. How are you all handling that?
Well, I'll give you a specific example that our district did just this past year. We have a junior high and elementary school that's a little over 900 students, and we're in a time when our class sizes are up, our enrollment's up, poverty, students living in poverty is up, and students who have IEPs are up. Many of our families are dealing with crises at home, and we have no supports for them. We had no counselor at our elementary and junior high school, so we partnered with a neighboring district to split a counselor between the two of us. And that's the state it had gotten to. One, it was hard to find counselors. We had very few applicants for the position. We were blessed to find an excellent person and an excellent candidate for the job. But schools are struggling with filling positions like counselors, having mentoring supports for teachers, having interventions for students, coaches for teachers to grow in the classroom. And all of those are areas we have to look at to bring in and help each other out with the school districts. We're also looking at ways we can share our vocational resources and our vocational classes because those teachers are so difficult to find.
Superintendent Blyer, as Superintendent Cox is sort of talking about the whole idea of pooling resources, I wanted to go back to something Senator Berkman said. He said he's heard concerns on both sides of the aisle about dumbing down requirements, not attracting a qualified enough teachers. To be clear, that's something he said, that he thought the process could be made simpler without lowering the quality of teachers. What do you think about that?
I think that is absolutely right. I just kind of, when we were talking about this last week, thought back when I came through the system and became a teacher in the early 90s, I wasn't having to go through near the hoops that these prospective educators are now. And knowing that that's ahead of you, a lot of those candidates are just not really interested in moving forward. I've heard the stories about not passing the basic skills test. I'm not sure how to respond to that. But if what Senator Lightford said, if it's assessing something maybe that isn't necessary, maybe that is something they could look at. But any kind of infringement towards moving forward into the field, it just isn't good for education in general. And when No Child Left Behind was established in the 2000s, I think that had an effect on the field itself, because if you know, that law basically set up a parameter that every school was going to not make it or basically fail under the eyes of No Child Left Behind. And I think that had that demoralizing effect that the two centers were talking about on the field. So there's some deep-rooted issues there. Of course, the universities are struggling. That's not helping. So all these are kind of like a perfect storm right now.
Yeah, so that's my last question to both of you. Superintendent Blyer, maybe you can start in terms of the strain this puts on existing staff. What would you all like to see in terms of change and support? And it sounds like everybody would agree that there's not enough. So I wonder what you would like to see.
I would like to see right now, to be honest with you, on our substitute teaching situation. We can't get any subs, period. And I would like to see the Illinois State Board come off of their requirements for what it is to be a sub. Right now we have a lot of people that could come in and do a sub position, but they're not qualified under state law, and I just don't I'd like to see that maybe looked at more aggressively to help us in our rural areas. I don't know what's going on with Dan, but getting subs is becoming extremely difficult, and that's probably more of an issue for me right now than getting qualified teachers.
Superintendent Cox?
I'd like to see it focused on the test of academic proficiency. That's what we've transitioned to from the basic skills test to the TAP. This test, it's equivalent to a passing this test is the equivalent of getting a 26 on the ACT, and it's all been done in the name of rigor, which when you look at the definition of rigor from Merriam-Webster, it's the quality of being unyielding and inflexible, and it's requiring teachers. A good example is it's requiring elementary teachers, for example, to be proficient in all academic areas. So they have to be proficient in reading, language arts, math, and writing. And we need our elementary teachers to be our reading experts, but they also have to have relationships with their students. They have to love and support their kids. And we can find quality teachers who can do well on the TAP test, but by focusing on their exact academic area. Right now we have a 21% passage rate, or at least the last time I looked, it was a 21% passage rate on the TAP test. And I think a few changes can be done to help with that. We are about accountability. We're not saying we want to not have our teachers accountable and our students accountable. That is important to us, but I think some common sense approaches can do that. We can start by prioritizing grade level and subject matter on the test by grade level, by schools, by subject areas for middle school and high school. That's a good first step.
That's Superintendent Dan Cox from Staunton, Illinois. I want to thank as well Superintendent Chuck Blyer from Golconda, helping us explain a little bit more about this problem. I appreciate your time, gentlemen. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Nyla.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Birds flying into your windows, dropping unwanted, let's call them surprises, on your head when you're out walking, or even hawks and owls going after tiny pets. It's not unusual for conflicts to occur between humans and birds, especially as more and more birds pop up in urban areas. And while some love observing birds, for others, they're a pest. Because of this, University of Illinois experts hosted a Twitter discussion last week to answer bird-related questions, and we've got two of those professors involved with that chat in our Urbana studio, Jeff Braun and Mike Ward. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Glad to be here.
Jeff, you're the head of the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. What made you want to host this discussion about birds in more urban areas?
Well, you know, Illinois is an urbanizing state. You know, more and more people are in urban environments. And it's really important for, if you're going to consider natural resources, birds, or anything else, in order to be able to understand how humans interact with wildlife and birds, and how do we conserve wildlife and birds in urban environments, because we're getting more and more accustomed to that.
Mike, can you share with us some of the questions you received? I imagine they reflected passion from both sides, of people from bird lovers and people who, and I guess I should distinction, we're saying bird lovers, but I imagine there are people who maybe love some types of birds and hate, for example, pigeons.
Oh, yeah. So there's definitely a large percentage of people that like to have birds in their backyard, like to feed birds, like to see birds. And then there's the people that don't like geese, generally speaking, and pigeons. But geese are the species that really drives a wedge between some people.
They're kind of scary. Have you ever had I've had geese try to like take a sandwich out of my hand. It's not fun.
Oh yeah, they're very aggressive, especially when they're nesting. They'll come at you. I mean, they can't really hurt you, but it definitely is unnerving when they start hissing at you and fly at you.
Right. So, Jeff, were there any questions that you all got that really surprised you?
Not really. You know, there were a lot of really informed questions. I mean, people asked us about, you know, what is the value of birds in urban systems? Mike's been doing a lot of research on geese and O'Hare Airport and whatnot, or Midway. And so we got questions about, you know, why are there so many geese in and why are they increasing in the Chicago area? So there's just kind of a diversity.
Sure. Let me ask you, why are they, when we're thinking about that, I mean, Jeff, isn't this the time of year that we shouldn't really be seeing geese? Or sorry, Mike, I should ask you because you're the one. Why are they still hanging out in Illinois?
Sure. So geese, you know, traditionally migrated south through this area. But over the last few decades are wintering further and further north. And there's other species doing this as well. And that urban areas are provide the resources that geese and other birds need. And so instead of heading down to, you know, more southern quines, they are hanging around with us all winter. And a lot of times they're in our parks or in our backyards or in other areas in cities and in agricultural areas as well.
Jeff, how much of that is because of climate change? Is it warm enough that they're able to stay? Or is it just more to Jeff's point about urban areas and being a good environment for them?
Yeah, so there's a little bit about climate change. So our winters have gotten a little more mild over the last few years, but we still have really bad days, right? And so if you're a goose and you're wintering in Chicago, you could still get a foot of snow and it could be negative 20. And so it's not necessarily the weather itself. It's that we're providing resources like warm water discharges, and the birds themselves are changing. And so we often think about how we change the environment and how people want to feed birds, but the birds themselves change their behavior. And we found in Chicago that these geese are using pretty unique habitats and really taking advantage of what we provide to make it through those really cold, snowy days.
Yeah. So are there any benefits that urban birds are offering to cities? Like, are they, or can we be grateful for, like, for example, geese in our cities?
Well, I think some people would question whether geese offer benefits. I mean, some people really like looking at them. But overall, it's just nice to have birds around. People really enjoy seeing them. They can be colorful, especially during migration. A lot of people in Chicago area is wonderful for migration. So it's just people that are enthusiasts or people that want to spend time outdoors. It just adds to the experience. They also eat a lot of mosquitoes, and they, you know, to a certain extent can pollinate flowers and whatnot. So they offer some what we call ecological services, but they have intrinsic value, and there's actually big business in the bird feeding industry, so they contribute to the economy as well.
Right. And Jeff, I mean, I'm thinking about certain times of year. There's certainly, do we see across the state, I know in the Chicago area, there are different areas, particularly along the lake, where there are nesting for migrating birds and there are sanctuaries. Are there enough of those throughout the state?
Well, you can always ask for more habitat for migrating birds or resident birds. We've lost a lot of our natural habitat in the state. So for forest birds and wetland birds and for grassland birds, habitat is in short supply. So anything we can do to accommodate migrating birds that are just traveling through in terms of food resources or places to rest, good things will come from it.
And Mike, as we think about that, there was some controversy in Chicago about the new Apple store and the lights and birds that were flying into it because it was so brightly lit. I know that the new Apple store in downtown Chicago toned down the lights after some complaints about this. I know this is particularly a problem with skyscrapers. Is it unavoidable to have, when you have a skyscraper, to have birds flying into windows?
No. So there's lots of things we can do. We worked with Mayor Daley years ago in trying to get the Lights Out program going, which is going in Chicago, where you turn the lights out if you're not using them at night. A good example is, you know, McCormick Place, where literally they'd use a wheelbarrow to pick up the dead birds every night when they leave the lights on. Now you turn the lights off and very few birds hit it. So there's definitely things we can do to help the birds see these areas and not fly into it. Making really bright windows causes the birds to get disoriented and they fly in there, or they see reflections of vegetation. And there's lots of different, you know, small things that we can do. And it's really, to me, it's encouraging to see that things like this, one of the Apple Store, or there was an issue with the Minnesota Viking Stadium in Minneapolis, where we can, people recognize this, architects are recognizing this and the lay people, and go out there and figure out ways to mitigate the threat.
Gentlemen, we just have about a minute left, but I have to ask you, of course, because it's Thanksgiving week, if we can talk turkey for a second, and if you can tell us about, does this Illinois have native turkeys?
It sure does. Their populations were down earlier in the 1900s, but we have more and more turkeys. They seem to be expanding. People hunt them, and they can actually be an urban issue as well. Years ago, we had group of turkeys that came into the Champaign area and were bothering kids and whatnot. They're large birds, and they can be pretty aggressive. But
as bad as geese?
I don't know how to rate that.
They're pretty bad. They can be pretty aggressive. But again, it's a success story. So they were gone from Illinois for decades, and now they're back, and a good game species. So.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with me. Both professors at University of Illinois Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. We'll tweet out a link to, if you have more questions about birds, to see if Mike Ward and Jeff Braun answered them. Our handle's 21ST Show. We'll also put it up at our website, 21stshow.org. Mike, Jeff, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having
thank
us.
You.
That does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from the McNeil Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.